you for the night's rest. Thank you for this day and for what it holds for us. And we look forward with anticipation of that which you've got for us this morning. Pray that you'll guide Howie as he speaks to us, give him wisdom to discern that which he should leave out and that which he should put in, and what we need. So, Lord, we look to you for this hour. In Jesus' name, amen.
At our last hour, men, I was sharing with you some means of preparing a counseling for your counseling session. I'd like to urge you to do some experimentation in this area because it's a wide open field, and frankly, some of the most contributory things I have discovered have come in this realm. Let me suggest one or two others to you. First of all, the use of search questions to get a person into the Word for himself. Now, if you've had no experience with this, I would suggest that you look at some of the InterVarsity Bible Study booklets, which will give you a pattern. You can structure your own questions, but this will give you some direction as to the technique. I would particularly call to your attention two booklets recently produced by InterVarsity, which in my judgment are very tangent to the ministry of the Navigator. One is entitled On Becoming a Man and the other On Becoming a Woman. These are masterpieces. And in these days of confused roles, when we're masculinizing women and feminizing men, it's good to get back to the Word of God. And these are all direct Bible studies. In other words, they're just a series of questions, but they're so directional that they get a person to come to grips with the truth for himself. They're very well done. Another technique I would suggest to you is the use of projects. In other words, where you ask a person to do two or three things in the next week. And then report back to you. In other words, what you are doing is getting some kind of commitment in terms of action. You're getting the person to do something. And as we'll see in a moment, this is basic to the process of motivation. Another technique is the use of reading, assigned reading. And what you want to do is to keep your fingers upon the kinds of reading that get the job done. Little booklets, pamphlets. I sometimes wish I could take some of these huge books that are very contributory but that blow a person's mind and rip them up chapter by chapter. As a matter of fact, I have done this. And I put each chapter in a little binder. This is a pamphlet. And I say to this guy, you know, who hasn't read anything for the last 15 years, hey, my friend, I'd like you to read something. He looks at me in 7 pages. You don't call back up on next week? Well, try it. And so the old boy plows his way through. He comes back. He says, hey, that was right good, man. I said, right, you'd like to read some more? Sure would. Fine. Chapter 2. You know, and the first thing you know, the guy's through 12 chapters without even knowing it. But you give him this tome, and he takes one look at that and thinks, wow. And what usually happens is you psych him out. Now, the art of bibliotherapy is the art of knowing how to select the books for the particular individual. And you can accomplish an awful lot through this. By the way, I would also include in this tapes, these cassettes are gold. I have a medical doctor in my area who gets every tape that's ever made of me that he can get his hands on. And between his office and the hospital or calls or his home, he plays these tapes. This guy can quote me better than I can quote myself. And it's amazing how this stuff comes across to a person, just by repeated hearing. And you communicate a lot. Another thing, and one you are sold on, is Bible memory and meditation. Man, to me, there is nothing quite like this. Get a man thinking for a week, what are you thankful for? And come up with some very specific things. All right, there are many more, but this will hold you and hopefully stimulate you. Now, let's look at the solution phase. This is the phase of appropriation. Now, relate it to the insight phase. Notice how the arrows are drawn in that original diagram I gave to you. In other words, in the insight phase, the man apprehends the truth. In the solution phase, he appropriates it. The one, he says, I understand it. And the other, he says, I'm going to use it. Now, there are two routes that are possible following insight. One is acceptance, the other is rejection. Watch the danger of rejecting the counselee because he rejects the solution, thus proving that your original acceptance was conditional and therefore superficial. It's my experience that some of the most effective work I do initially is met with opposition, total rejection. No way. In fact, sometimes with a lot of hostility. But boy, 2 months later, it's an altogether different story. And you've got to take the long-range view in counseling. That's the only way to get the job done. The Isaiah 55 passage is extremely relevant. Concerning the Word of God, it will accomplish that which I please, not you. It will prosper in the thing whereunto I send it, not the one for which you design it. So, you're going to have to let God do His work in His time. Now, there are three problem areas with respect to solution. One is the problem of motivation. The second is the problem of confidence. The third is the problem of choice. Let's look at them briefly. First, the problem of motivation, or overcoming initial inertia. People make progress when they move, when they act, when they get off the dime. It's very easy to direct a moving object. And the principle is this: you help the counselee to desire improvement, progress, and growth. And I quoted Fenelon, who said, "The essence of Christianity resides in the will." A choice illustration of this is John 5. A man paralyzed 38 years, and the text says, when Jesus saw that he had been there that long, he said, "Do you want to be made whole?" And I can still remember my first reaction. Imagine going into a hospital ward where a guy's been on a bed 38 years and saying, "Man, would you like to get better?" That's a very significant statement, because this man had more than paralyzed legs. He had a paralyzed will. And a lot of people with whom you are working are in precisely that place. And this is an extremely perceptive question. Now, let's look at what is involved in motivating an individual. First of all, it involves an accurate diagnosis of the problem. That is, you've got to determine the causative problem. Is the problem physical? My friend, if it's physical, you can quote scripture from now till the Lord returns and you'll never solve his problem. He's got a malfunctioning liver. Scriptures do not heal this. He needs medicine. Sometimes the problem is emotional, and I find it very easy to give this bromide. Trust the Lord, brother. And it's a cop-out. The guy is an emotionally handicapped individual. He has never known what it is to receive love. And it is not until you surround this guy with love and minister to it to him over a period of time where he learns how to accept it and thrive under it and give it back, that he ever makes any progress. And just telling him to trust the Lord may simply complicate his problem. In fact, I don't know how many people I've had come to me and say, I have serious questions about God's ability. I said to a guy, "Why? What? What caused you to come to that conclusion?" "Well," he said, "I in counseling with this minister, and the only thing he says is, trust Jesus." And he said, "Man, I'm trusting Jesus so hard I can taste it. But," he said, "I've still got this problem. And I'm beginning to wonder if he's able to do anything." Spiritual. And by the way, there are more problems in this category than I think even we are one to understand. But suppose a man's problem is basically spiritual. The forgiveness of sins, for example. You can send him to a psychiatrist till he's shot every dime he's got, and he'll never get over his problem. Until he learns to accept forgiveness that God has provided in Jesus Christ. Or, as I said, sometimes it is interrelated, and that's when it gets sticky. Does it center in a home, job, friends, the counselee? All of these are clues to motivation. Otherwise, you are motivating a man on the wrong area. That's why you make no progress. Second, it involves removing the blocks, and I've given you several ways by which this may be done. Third, understanding motivational means. And someday, when I come to the Glen, since this happens to be my bag in education, I'd like to explore these eight areas with you. We could well spend considerable time. Because in my judgment, the key to discipleship, the key to education, the key to spiritual growth is motivation. That's it. And the art of ministering is the art of learning how to motivate. And what I've done is just shared with you what really is the outline of a book I hope to eventually develop in this area. And I'm straining at the leash to get into this, but we better move on.
Do you have some tapes that you've had made at another conference, perhaps, that deal with this area that we could just listen to?
I have only one tape, but I think it would be worth your listening to. It's available through Campus Crusade. It's the message I gave at their staff conference last year on motivation. And it's an expansion of these. I think you were the one that told me, weren't you?
Yeah, I have a copy of that one, but it's not a very good copy. It's a very poor, master.
I've had some problems with them over this, but that's the only one that I know. I'm sure there are others, but everybody has my tapes except me. And I would... It'd be hard for me to tell. If I run into some, I'll be glad to let you know, and you can put it in one of your communications as to where it is. I don't allow tapes in my class. This is why I don't have any from the seminary where I go into this more in detail.
Are there any books that you could recommend on this topic?
Amazingly enough, despite the fact that it's extremely significant and there is an awful lot written, there is an amazingly small amount that really hits in on the target in terms of you. I can give you books like that, but after you get through, you'd be so unmotivated that it'd be unreal. But I mean, to get something that distills all of this research that's been done and puts it in something that you can get a hold of, this is what I want to try to do with this. Well,
are these eight here so diverse in their application that one is not more important than another? Or are you listing them here in the order of their...
No, there is no reference to order here, whatever, Walt. They are equally significant. None is more important than the other for the simple reason that the heart of motivation is finding what button to push in this guy. And that's my thesis, that everyone can be motivated, but not in the same way or by the same person.
Well, the reason I ask the question, how is, when you begin to push buttons, you've got eight of them to push, let's say... Are there some that you start pushing first because more guys will respond to this button than, let's say, the other button?
Yes. For example, C is almost universal because the great need of an individual is acceptance. It's recognition. And your great problem today, as I've alluded to before, is inferiority feelings. It's lack of self-confidence. And therefore, you don't build a man by tearing him down. And we do this all the time. We get a guy in, you know, and okay, you need to lead the Bible study. I'll sit on the side. So you sit on the side, you take all your critical notes, and when he gets through and everybody leaves, you say, well, friend, we sure got a lot of work here. My shattered nerves. Look what I got. I filled up both sides of this thing. 27 things wrong with it. And that really turns him on. I'm so convinced of this that looking you straight in the eye, I'm convinced that many of you will never realize your potential for one reason. You really don't know what you got going for you yet. You cannot pinpoint, that is my asset. So is that. And God gave me that, and He's recently developed this. And you work on the basis of your strengths. See, most of you know better your weaknesses than you know your strengths. And I maintain I never get a guy to move significantly until I can finally say, look, this is what you've got going for you, my friend. That has to be your leverage, your source of confidence. And when he finds that, boy, we start taking off. Then I say, well, would you like something that would help you to improve it? I've never had a guy yet say, no, I really wouldn't. See, he's so excited now. Yeah, that is great, isn't it? Right, and God gave it to you. You like some help? Boy, I sure would. What do you got? Okay, let me show you here a couple things. And he's ready to bite at this point.
In the ministry that we do, a lot of it depends on, you can train just about anyone to do it. But a lot of times it depends on how rapidly you can train. That's, none of us like that situation particularly, but that's where we live. Applying this principle in that environment, would you speak to that? I know it's a vague question and a vague comment, but obviously we can encourage and upbuild just about everybody, but is there a basis for selectivity?
Oh, certainly there's a basis of selectivity. You mean as to the people you are going to train?
Right. In applying this one, you have to be able to identify who can respond within a given time and a given set of pressure and circumstances, and who can't.
Yeah, my problem in answering your question, Chuck, is that I really don't, I'm not quite sure what you want me to... To direct myself to, and if I can get on that, maybe we can move.
Well, what you're saying is, as I read it, overlook some of a man's problems to develop his strength. And one of the things that I feel that we're forced to do is to identify a man's capacity fairly early in the game so that we decide whether or not we give him leadership type training or whether or not we just help him in his Christian experience. And, we deal with people on two different levels.
It's probably my lack of plug-in, to the program that fogs me at this point. Any of the rest of you guys can help me to pinpoint, because you identify perhaps more readily with us being in it. Because I think Chuck is asking an important question, but I'm trying to find it. How does it plug in? Well,
I'm not sure this is what Chuck is asking, but let me re-ask a question. To what degree does our ability to motivate a man determine whether or not we're willing to really invest in? In other words, a guy may be motivatable, but we haven't pushed the right button.
A great deal. In other words, the guy who is the gifted motivator is the guy who sees potential in people that other people would pass by. Is this?
Well, that's zero. And I'm thinking of a specific guy, for instance, that the decision was made to move him out of an apartment at a university. The guy loves the Lord. He's a good man. He's biggest things against him. He's not very masculine. He's not an attractor of the type of men that we normally fire up to go to the mission field. He's that sort of guy. Now, we've moved into a different area and we're going to try to develop his gifts of working with younger people. So I'm in the process of assessing how much I invest in that guy and how much I draw him in and program him in.
Right. Well, I think maybe what we're saying, too, is that you obviously have to make value judgments, and quite frankly, you will often be wrong just for your comfort. I'm speaking out of too much experience. What I'm saying also is that this guy has potential that you're going to have to determine in terms of how much time you have to invest, it's possible you may have to commit them to someone else who's able to take them on and develop this potential and make it contributory.
Well, that helps. The overriding word in all that you've said in these sessions to me is capacity. How much capacity do I have to do what you're challenging me to do?
This is very helpful. And what I would say is, and this is one reason why the whole area of self-development is very significant. The more significant a person you become as a disciple of Jesus Christ, the greater your capacity to disciple others. How could Jesus Christ take 12 people? I would never tell anybody, much less a man, to take 12 men and build his life into them and expect that they're going to be the disciples in the next generation. You're going to be the most disillusioned man in the world. Because Jesus Christ had all of the gifts. You do not. And therefore, you've got to follow the basic principle of exposing your disciples to a number of men with different gifts. Because these differing gifts will enrich that person so he comes out a balanced individual. Not simply with your strengths plus your weaknesses. And then you get a full-orbed development, and I think that here's a guy, for example, I'm working with. I'm not making a grade, but another professor comes along, builds in his life, the guy turns on, goes like crazy. We'll talk a little more about this also later. All right? Introduce the counselee to spiritual resources. And by the way, men, these six I want to share just briefly can be used in every one of these three problem areas. In other words, the problem of motivation, the problem of confidence, the problem of choice. So we're not repeating them each time. Number one, direct exposure to the Word of God. This can be through reading, through studying, through memorizing, through meditating. What you're trying to do is to structure this man's mentality according to the Scriptures. I put a couple of things under this. First, challenge the counselee with the why. We don't do enough of this, men. And I'm not talking about navigators. I'm talking about generally. We tell a person, get into the Word. Why? When I start a Bible study program with a group of people, I take the first entire session to sell them. Why? It is absolutely indispensable to get into the Word. And there are five or six crucial New Testament passages in this. The Hebrews 5 passage, the 1 Peter 2 passage, the 2 Timothy 3:16 passage, etc. You know them. Second, instruct and provide experience in the process. We tell people to get into the Word. That's how it all started with me. A guy led me to Christ and said, okay, Enix, get into the Word. I said, fine, where should I start? Ah, it's all profitable. So I opened, and the first place I landed was in Ezekiel. So help me, right in the middle of the wheels. Boy, and I read that thing, you know, and I was going like this, and I went, well, this must be an exception. So I whipped over to the back and landed in Revelation, in the bowls and the vials and the wrath. And I'm ashamed to tell you, but this is a fact. I closed that book for one solid year, and I was convinced that what they had taught me in a Roman Catholic church was true, and that is that you needed a professional milkman to dispense the stuff. And I never forget the next time a guy came to me and said, Howie, are you into the Word? I said, no, as a matter of fact, I'm not. He said, I'll come. I said, I'll tell you, I don't know how. He said, sit down. And he gave me a very simple process to get me started. Now, I think that oftentimes we're telling people what to do, but not enough how to do it. And you have done some fantastic things in this realm, and may your tribe increase. Third, serve as a guide, that is, study with him. Philip and the Ethiopian eunuch in Acts chapter 8 is very much to the point. The man had a copy of the Scriptures, but he needed a guide. Second, the influence of Christian brethren, the fact that we are now in a new family. And if you're working with the present generation, this is the most exciting thing in all of the world to these kids. And sometimes I think they know more about it than the soporific saints who've been in the family for 25 years. There are four things that I put under this. First, the preaching of the Word. That is, if it is expositional, if it is really teaching people. I don't think we need any more sermons on the hands of Jesus. They're comforting hands, they're gracious hands, they're loving hands, they're pierced hands, they're serving hands. Man, I can make it up right here while we're going. We need some teaching of the Word of God that's got some substance to it. And mind you, the average layman is fed up with a setup because he's tired of playing games, hearing this kind of nonsense. He doesn't want to waste his time. When he goes to church, he wants to sink his teeth into something that feeds him, that equips him. And I think a lot of the disenchantment with the church is really a disenchantment with the kind of preaching that goes on in the average church. No feeding here. That doesn't motivate you. Second, personal exhortation. Hebrews 10 passage is much to the point. Don't forsake the assembling of yourself together, and so much the more. But exhorting one another, provoking one another. Well, we do a good job of that, except that it says unto love and good works. John 13 is another passage you should put here. Jesus washing the disciples' feet, and notice he said he left you an example. Make sure when you start washing the feet of the saints, you don't use scalding water. Third, the example of other Christians. And may I suggest, and we'll talk a little more about this later, that you study the whole concept of modeling in the New Testament. It's the most enriching study I've engaged in this last year.
Could you describe a little bit more on that?
Yes, this is the whole concept that Bandura at Stanford has researched extensively and shown that you can teach almost anything as effectively by modeling as you can by direct experience. By what I see you do, I learn extremely much from this. In fact, I learn more from this than I do from what you tell me to do, whether I'm your child, your disciple, type of thing. I think I counted up about 18, 20 times in the New Testament alone. Paul, not to mention John and others, use this concept. Fourth, the fortress of Christian fellowship. By the way, it's the greatest dynamic that we've got going for it, and it's the one we're kicked apart. See, the greatest contribution of a church is its fellowship. Well, when do we have fellowship? Oh, we have coffee and donuts every Sunday night, I remember. I wonder how in the world did the early church have fellowship without coffee and donuts? Very simple. They had persecution. And as an Indian, what an experience. We had a pastor's conference outside of the state of Assam, one of the communist-controlled states, where it's against the law to preach the gospel. And to that conference came three pastors who had just been released from prison for preaching the gospel. I said, men, what's it like in Assam? They said, just like the book of the Acts. They said, the more they persecute us, the more we flourish. We're now up to, we started with 2 services, 3 services, 4 services. We're now up to 5 services every Sunday morning to accommodate the people who want to come. And finally, the elders came together and they said, hey, pastor, we're discovering some of these people coming to more than one service. So they got up one day and they said, look, some of you people are coming to more than one service, and that's bad news. One service only. So if you come to a second service, we're going to ask you to leave, because there are other people that want to get onto the work. Well, that worked for a while, and then finally, they got together and they came up with another rule. They said, look, if you come this Sunday, you stay home next Sunday. One Sunday on, one Sunday off. Just like it is in Colorado Springs. But for an altogether different reason. And you emerge from this kind of an experience saying, how can we launch a persecution? Has it really been bugging you that they're out for your throat on a campus or base you're working? Friend, thank God. You know what disturbs me about the average university campus? It's not that they're nailing us to the wall. We're not that significant. We're just tolerated. Boy, I was up at Wisconsin, I never saw anything that excited me more. This guy said, put on some grubs, will you, buddy, and let's go out to the campus and see what's happening. So we went out to the free speech platform, Campus Crusade Boy. And I'd say 2 out of every 3 kids on that free speech platform were evangelical Christians.
And I'm telling you, they were up there really cutting loose, talking about Jesus and what he had done to them. And man, some of them couldn't speak for sour apples. But boy, they were up there. And they were shouting epithets and cussing them out. One guy, while he was there, got a tomato bang right in the eye, and he wipes it off and keeps on going. Another kid gets down and hands this kid a Gospel of John. The guy takes the Gospel of John, rips it in shreds, throws it in his face, and spits in it. And man, that kid was galvanized. I said to this guy, do you do this all the time? All the time. Why? He said, two objectives. Number one, to keep Christianity a live option on this campus. And number two, to galvanize Christians. He said, all you got to do is to put a kid on that box once, and he's never the same. And I really think, men, that what comes out of the persecution of sending your disciples out into a real world where the bullets are real and where they're being shot at, and then come back for fellowship to share. You see, the reason we have so little fellowship in many a church is nothing's happening. What in the world do you got to share? Your misery? So what do we talk about in the church, in the fellowship? What kind of time fellowship? We talk about the Cowboys. They really blew it with Baltimore. Talk about the weather. That's a fantastic thing to talk about because you can't do a thing about it. That's the kind we like to talk about. They talk about, you know, the political situation. Everything that you can talk about in any tavern. But how much talk is going on about Jesus Christ and his work? See, that's the fortress of Christian fellowship. Third area, chastisement and confession. And you ought to study these passages with the concept of the sin unto death. It's a very serious one. 1 Corinthians 5, 1 John 5, Acts 5. The whole thing is telescoped in 1 Corinthians 11:31. For this reason, some are weak, sickly, sleep. That's the process. Prayer for himself, praying for other people, you're praying for him. Never ceases to amaze me to have a student say to me, you mean you really pray for me, Prem? I said, absolutely. Good night. Christian service. By the way, men, don't prohibit without providing. Don't tell him what he can't do unless you can tell him what he can do. And that's a great therapeutic, particularly for people suffering from grief, particularly for people who are all hung up with themselves. Get them flowing into the life of another person. And then they're not so hung up with themselves. Christian literature and tapes. I put here a pastor's loan shelf. Just change it to your own. A fourth area, or fifth area here, helping the counselee secure perspective in terms of benefits. Oh, this has really come home to me. You know what? It is my judgment in terms of what we were talking about the other night, you know, in his ministry to businessmen. You know what I think we don't do? We do not surface what are the desires, the aspirations of man. And you know what I've discovered? When I surface, what does this man want? At heart, I come back to that's exactly what Jesus Christ is in business to give you. But see, people are still covered over with this idea. Paul Little said it so well. A celestial Scrooge looking down over the parapets of heaven and saying, hey, are you enjoying life? Yeah, God, cut it out. Oh, that's beautiful. Now, how many times have I had a person say to me, well, it can't be the will of God, Prof. Why? I'm enjoying it. I love to do it. That's the amazing thing, that it is the will of God that I teach when I'd rather teach than eat. And they pay me for it. Not much. But I should really pay them. Sixth, a volitional decision. If any man wills to do his will, he shall know the doctrine. Philippians 2, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling because God works both within, both to will and to do. Seventh, devise means of communicating concepts. Understanding is basic to usage. And we could spend a great deal of time on this, but I just brought along one that I have devised. You make up your own. I love to use something like this, just an 8.5 by 11 sheet, folded twice. And I'm talking to this guy about the will of God. So I say, here, it's the will of God. I write his name across the bottom. So would you like to know what the will of God is? Oh, sure, I'd like to know. I got it right here. Really? Mm-hmm. You open it up, Romans 12,
1 and 2, it's good, it's acceptable, it's perfect. I just take some time. It's good. That's a word that's been raped in the English language, so you better explain it. See, if I'm selling a car to you, you say, what condition is it? I say, it's good. Say, what's the matter with it? Because they were so carried away with the superlative. My friend, that's the word that's used of God. It's as good as God is. It's acceptable, both in retrospect as in prospect. It's perfect. That means something to which nothing can be added. You couldn't take one thing away from it or add one thing to it and improve it. That's what I know about the will of God for your life. Man, that's tremendous. You interested in it? Yeah. Well, we'll give you more of the details. And I open it up and he discovers there's a blank sheet of paper with his name at the top. And I hand it to him and I say, friend, sign your name at the bottom. Well, he said, I don't know what the details are. No, you'll never find those until you sign your name. You know what the will of God is with most of us? Well, let me see, Lord. No, I'll check it out here. Just a minute. Look over it. Let's see, who am I going to marry? That's okay. Children? Oops. Hold it here. I got a couple conditions we want to put in the clause. Not. That little piece of paper, in terms of what I learned out of it, was a major departure in my Christian experience. I was hung up over going to Africa. I can't tell you why. But I think if I could have looked at the will of God and found that Africa wasn't in there, I'd say, right, Lord, count me in. And I still remember the day when I said, Lord, anywhere, including Africa. Boy, and God started to make it so plain to me. Never did include Africa. But he wanted me to be willing to do it. You know another one I use that you can get? You can make up the stuff yourself, friend. Get yourself, you got a doctor friend somewhere, get him to get you a surgical glove. I have them right in my side drawer. I carry them all the time, just standard office equipment. Because I get all kinds of people in there. And I shove pieces of chalk in it and pennies in it and a paper clip in it and any kind of junk I can find in it. And I'd say, here, friend, put this thing on. Oh, guy thinks the thing starts putting on. He says, hey, you got something in here. Oh, really? And we start emptying all of this stuff out. And then I say, why don't you pick something up with a glove? Boy, say, I got to put my hand in it. Oh, no, don't bother to do it. Just pick it up. You ever try to pick up something with a glove? Well, so he says, look, friend, obviously you can't pick it up. You got to put your hand in it. Okay, put your hand in it. And I start showing him how to pull these things down over his fingers. The glove's got to be empty. It's got to be filled. It's got to be clean. And I've got enough to keep him going for a little while. Flashlight, I use this all the time in terms of showing him that he can't find the will of God for what's down the road. He doesn't need to know that. When he gets down there, the headlights on his car will be there. Oh, I love to do this when I'm with a group of guys, especially athletes, you know, and a guy say, hey, Joe, come on up, buddy. We're going to put on some calisthenics today. All right, Joe, they all give him a hand. Woo, he's our man. And so I start going through some calisthenics slowly at first. Follow me, buddy. And he follows. I just get a little faster and screw them all up. And I say, well, sorry about that, man. Try a little harder, will you? Now watch me carefully because it's very important that you watch me. You know, try to do what I do. So we go through the same thing, you know, and I hung them up like crazy. You know, by this time the group is identifying. Until finally I say, look, you really need some help. And so I go over behind him and I whisper in his ear, resist. And I try to pull his arms up and he's going like this each time. And finally I say, relax. And he relaxes and I start moving his hands like this. And I teach him that the Christian life is not imitating. It's not trying. It's not resisting. It's relaxing and entrusting another to direct you. You know, what I found with this kind of thing is long after they've forgotten all of your messages and the rest of the stuff you put out, they'll never forget you were the guy that taught me this. And I just wish you could think up more of these things, and I have enough confidence in you that most of you could do it if you try more. All right, the problem of confidence is the next one. Principal, encourage the counselee to believe that with God's power he can solve this problem. Now, men, the man must come to the end of himself.
This is why, when I get a person who tries and tries and falls flat on his face and says, man, I can't, I say, friend, you know, you may be on the verge of the greatest spiritual discovery in your life. Because, see, he's usually thinking, man, I'm wiped out. No, you're at the point of insight. You can. You can't, others can't, I can't, but he can. But notice what I've added, not without you. You see, nobody's going to wake up someday and say, well, here I am, spiritual, never wanted to be, just couldn't help it. No, it's never going to happen apart from you. This is all the force of the New Testament command. Second, expose the counselee to biblical truth that inspires confidence. And I've given you four illustrations. You can multiply them yourself. Right.
Excuse me, one moment. Without going into too much here, back on that number one, because some of the men will be reading Jay Adams' book, and he has a section in there on can't is a word that you don't allow anyone to use. Could you just put it into a perspective for us all so that when we read that, we don't get confused?
Yes, I think that probably part of this comes out of his ultra-Calvinistic viewpoint theologically. But I think that basically he's setting forth a good principle. In other words, what he's saying is that God is not in a process of mocking you. He's not asking you to do something for which he doesn't provide the power. He's not saying, ha, 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 you didn't live the Christian life, did you? Playing sort of a game of sacred hide-and-seek. And I think in that sense, it is very, very helpful. And this is the way I use it. But I, to give the adverse side of the coin, I love to pick up him telling me I can. Because I often say, you're right. And to dramatize this sometimes, I'll say to him, you know, my friend, the Christian life is not only a difficult life, it's an impossible life. It's a supernatural life. That's why the Holy Spirit took up his residence in you to enable you to live the life of Christ. You can't live the life of Christ without him. See, then he gets in a whole new perspective in terms of this. And I think a new confidence. Anticipate the possibility of casualties. Men, this is very important. I think sometimes we give a person something that's good, but we give them this with the idea, friend, take this and from now on that's the end of your problem. And it just doesn't work that way. It's a process. The best analogy you have is the biblical analogy of walking. Take each and every step, Paul said, by means of the Spirit. How do you learn to walk? By walking. I have four kids that have gone through this. You know the process. The kid pulls himself up in a playpen, you know, and stands there, wobbles, and goes around like this. Pretty soon, bang, down he goes again. Pretty soon he can stand up, and you put him outside the thing, and he takes a few steps with you holding onto him. Pretty soon he spots that chair across there, and he starts across the room, and his feet are going faster than he is, and... And you've heard it every time, haven't you? He says, shucks, I guess I just never was called to walk. No, he gets up and walks and falls and walks and falls and walks and walks and falls, and he never gets to the place where he will not fall. It's always a live option. But he learns not to fall by learning how to walk. And I find that so many people are utterly disillusioned, and I don't mean to be bitter, and I don't mean to be overly critical, but I'm honest. It's my experience in counseling that the average spiritual life teaching to which a person is exposed is so perfectly confusing, so highly idealistic, that a person can never plug into it. And if I would say that the NAVs have contributed anything, it's that they have been guts men who just won't stand for that nice little idealistic stuff that somebody puts out. They're always saying, how? Get it down here where I can get a hold of it. And keep doing that, men, because it'll make you a realist and it'll make your disciples realists. Otherwise, all you're doing is teaching them to live in an unreal world. And life is not lived in that world. Sounds nice, it just doesn't work that way. So I introduce them to the remedy right from the start, as well as the reality of failure and to the recognition that they're never alone. The Hebrews 13:5 passage is very much to the point. Now, the third area is the problem of choice. And the principle is to lead the counselee to accept responsibility and to act responsibly. Make it clear that you will assist him, but you will not assume his responsibility. I direct, but I cannot do. Only you can do that. Further, throw down a personal spiritual challenge. Have you ever noticed how much God speaks in the imperative? 54 sharp commands in James alone. 108 verses. And it's very interesting working with parents, for example, who finally come to the place where they say, well, I've been trusting God, but now what? I'd say, well, friend, now's your opportunity to trust. You don't have to trust God for very much when everything's going well. But now you have no way to look, right? But up. That's right. Great. Now you'll learn what it means to trust. Another good passage to use, by the way, is the Psalm 11 passage. If the foundations be destroyed, what shall the righteous do? Answer, go right on trusting. We, all of these neurotics in our society say, oh, what's going to happen to our society? What's going to happen to our country? What's going to happen to our church? I don't know, my friend. But I know one thing, no matter what happens to it, go right on trusting. My wife and I have been studying this week together in connection with some of the stuff she's been writing. And, you know, we tend to become spiritual neurotics concerning our time until you get back into the Scriptures and discover the times in which some of these people lived. And, friend, everything was falling apart at the seams. And, mind you, these were the covenant people of God. And a whole thing is going to pot. And there's one guy just going right on, one woman, trusting God. And that's what he honors in any generation. Third, agree upon a plan of action. In other words, what are you planning to do? And then I arrange to see the counselee after a period of time for a checkup. And that's especially true if it's a habit pattern. And Alcoholics Anonymous, Weight Watchers, etc., has just put into a very basic principle of working with people, and that is you need a checkup. Find out how are you coming. Now, the fifth one is key to me. Break down the task into bite-sized parts. It's my judgment that we tend to hit people with too much. You know, we give them one big wad of assignment. In fact, sometimes you will be very tempted. I just finished with a case that a couple of years ago when I got it, I kid you not, it took me so many sessions to find out what the problem was that by the time I got to the end of the thing, I thought to myself, where in the world do you start? Why, it's so complicated, it had gone so far that it had literally affected every single area of this guy's life. Well, my friend, you're not going to solve this problem by starting on the whole. We're going to have to get one area. And this is what I've learned through bitter experience. I get a man functioning in one area. And when he starts making improvement in that area, I use that with leverage to move on to another. From a motivational point of view, it's the thing that a guy responds to like that. We're making progress. Long way to go, right, but progress. And it's taken now 2 years, and he's not completely out of the woods, but he's so far out of them that he wonders if he has a problem compared with what he had when he started. Six, provide personal support, but again, avoid paternalism. This man Bob going with him initially, having him call you at stated times, and over a period of time, you break this kind of a relationship and continue to have him moving on his own. Finally, always leave the door of opportunity open for further help. Encourage people to return when it's needed. And I have what I call the open door approach in counseling. Never slam the door on a person in a counseling situation. I had a woman in Fort Worth a number of years ago. I'll never forget. In fact, every time I go to McKinney Church, where Walt goes, I meet this dear lady, and she reminds me of this. This dear woman went through the bottom 7 times in a row. I'll never forget. She came to see me. And man, she'd broken through the bottom, and I took the parts, and we tried to put it together, and we went to the Word, found the answer, etc. She went out, and I suppose went for about 3 weeks, and man, she made a bust. She told me later it took her 2 weeks to screw up enough courage to come back to me, and the only thing that ever brought her back was that I said, look, I want you to know you're always welcome to come back, no matter what the outcome is. And that gave her enough courage to come back. And we went through the thing again, and she went out, and it lasted about 6 months, and bang, through again. You know, along about the 6th or 7th time, the flesh starts to operate, you know, and you're beginning to say, look, lady, you know, this is the 6th time we've gone through this now. you know the answer, and please don't bother me anymore. I'm so glad that the Lord never accepted me on that basis, aren't you? How many times have you been to God with your problem? Well, you've lost count. Suppose he said to you the last time you came, look, friend, how many times are you going to come to me? Man, you've been 4,619 times, and you got the answer in a word. You've memorized it. Now, don't bother me again. Got so many people with hang-ups these days, it's getting confusing. The lines are clogged. Boy, always open. Always ready. Bring forth. This is the statement. Right.
One of the problems I think that many of us face is that, and I'm sure you face this more than we, is the scheduling problem, because it may take 2 weeks to get an appointment with you. Okay?
This is right.
And now, when I look at this open door, for instance, I had students say, well, you know, I really don't want to bother you. I know you don't have much time, but and I know there are many who probably don't come to see me, and I'm sure many in this room feel as if you travel very much or if you're busy, they feel like they're invading at various times. Not that you attempt to give them that impression, but just because they've tried to see you 3 times in a day.
Sure. And availability is one of the characteristics of a counselor. And if you're not available, no matter how good you are, they just don't come anymore. This is one reason why I believe if you guys are going to get the job done, you're going to have to apply the very principle you're teaching. And that's the principle of multiplying disciples. Only you're going to have to multiply counselors. And you're going to have to develop a core of counselors in your ministry to whom you can refer people. And by the way, some of these are people who have gone through the process of solving their own problems. That's what qualifies them to minister with understanding in the life of somebody else. And I think that if I can enlist a core of people with me, whether I'm in a church or in a school or in a area, in a home, that this would serve to multiply my ministry, because obviously you cannot carry the whole load. And as I'll show you in a moment, I think your wife can sustain a tremendous ministry in this area, and together I'll talk to you about some possibilities.
In the early part of the session, you on motivation, I'm wondering, I don't feel very professional on being able to determine when a person's problem is actually a physical, emotional, or spiritual problem. And I have a case now where one of our team leaders' wives, I've wondered for about a year whether she might be schizophrenic or not. And I have reasons to think that, but I don't know if I don't know where to go from here.
All right, let me answer it just directly, and then I want to move into the area in this next section to show you the kinds of people I think need professional help to help you identify these. But let me say this as a general rule of thumb. I mentioned it earlier. You may have missed it because of its context. Generally speaking, if you are working with an individual and you assume that the person's problem is spiritual and you go the traditional and effective routes of prayer, of the Word, sharing their faith, having a clear conscience before God, etc., and nothing happens, you have a clue that you may be on the wrong problem. And this is why oftentimes I work on a team ministry with another man. For example, I have several psychiatrists in our area with whom I work regularly. And if I'm in a situation like this where I think I'm over my head or I can't identify the problem, I will frequently refer them to this person who will diagnose the problem for me. And oftentimes I'm able to take it from there. But if I don't know what the problem is, you know, then you're like a doctor trying to prescribe a cure. And what he does is send him to an internist to find out from a good diagnostician what's the problem. And then we start the treatment on the basis of this.
How do you encourage them to go for that help when they probably don't think they need that help?
Yes. I would say in the little section in which I gave you, it, I think it's in the back of your thing, entitled Guidelines for Referral, which I don't have time, unfortunately, to go into in detail, you will find some of the clues in this area. But again, let me direct an answer to it. And that is, you use the confidence they have in you with leverage to get them to go to someone else. See, this person trusts me. And therefore, I say, on the basis of this, I want you to do something that will help me help you. And the interesting thing is, although they wouldn't go on their own, they would go because of their confidence in me. All right, let's look at the follow-up phase, which I've called the time of evaluation and conservation. Evaluation is something to which you are very sensitive, and I provided a good deal of backup material for you to evaluate the counselee and also to evaluate yourself. And I think you can study this better on your own. Let's look at the conservation aspect of follow-up. Few principles. First, recognize and refer persons needing professional help. Now, will you turn in your booklet? I don't know the page exactly here. Let me see if I can find it. Here it is, page 36. And let me just tick off a few things here. I have 17 specifics of people who, in my judgment, need professional help. And you will usually have to refer. Sometimes you can't, because you can't find an adequate referent. Number one, those who refuse to eat and complain that all food is distasteful. I'm talking about a person who enjoys eating but suddenly has a total loss of appetite. Secondly, those who have sensations of tingling or numbness in various parts of their body. They will tell you, for example, that their arm feels like it's on fire or it's got a million pins sticking it. And oftentimes you might add to this hysteria, which comes from the same source. It's just a different manifestation. This is the woman or the man who just cannot cease crying. In fact, they just walk into your presence and they dissolve, and it's almost compulsive. Those who have tics or twitches of the facial muscles. This is a neurotic spasm or twitching, usually affecting the face. And this is the person who's standing there like this, and all the time his face is going like this to you. You're not talking about something that may have been permanent damage, but you're talking about something that starts to appear on a person who otherwise does not have it. And that's beginning to show that there's a great deal of tension, anxiety in this individual. Much of what the people are talking about is spiritual. You ever notice that? They got all kinds of revelations. They're talking to Jesus Christ. They're one of the prophets. They're singing Jesus Saves. Boy, nothing that quite gets me is to go into a tavern. You ever notice why a guy, every time he gets up, he's going to sing, "Let's all sing Old Rugged Cross." Right, that's supernatural. That's the power of the enemy. And that's what comes out during this period of time. The same reason you had with the demons. They could never keep their mouth shut in the presence of Jesus Christ. And we ain't seen nothing yet in this area. I'm here to tell you for your encouragement. You better really drench yourself in the Word of God, because you are going to face spiritual problems that most of us in the ministry have never faced with the concentrated attack of the enemy in these days. Those who complain of migraine headaches, by the way, there are two primary forms of these, one that constricts and one that expands. And your important thing is to get the right kind of medicine. If not, you complicate the problem. Those who have delusions of grandeur, complain the world's against them. We call this paranoia, the persecution complex. And by the way, a lot of Christian workers slip into this thing. They're against me. Just don't appreciate me. The Elijah complex. I only am left, Lord, and I'm quitting. Turns in his prophet's bag. So now, take me home. It's the only prayer God never answered. Those who are hearing strange voices, feel designated as the Messiah, some other special representative for God. I've had them in my room saying, "Do you hear it? Do you hear it? It's going now. There it is again." By the way, with this paranoia, this type of individual you have is a person who is afraid of everything. I've had them in my office, you know, and they say, "Have you got a recorder on?" "No, I don't have a recorder over here." I said, "It isn't even plugged in." "Yeah, it runs on batteries, doesn't it?" "No," I said, "it doesn't have anything." And they come around, they look, I have two big closets, they open the door to the closets and look in. They come around the back side to see if I've got a bug. This is the type of person who is in extreme need. Those who are disoriented as to time, place, or person. I'll tell you the most common one you will get, and that is the person who has amnesia, which is an early stage of severe neurosis. It comes often with a lot of pressure. We had a guy at the seminary a few years ago, fantastic guy, and he's sustaining a fantastic ministry. But this old boy was under so much pressure that the guy just completely blanked out. He didn't even know who he was. Didn't know where he was. He came from Canada. We put him in the hospital for some treatment. Boy, I'll never forget, I had to go out and pick up his wife and fiance. I mean, his mother and fiance. Yeah, well, what's that problem there? Those who were disoriented.
No wonder he was in the
prayer. Yeah, we complicated it no end. I picked up his mother and fiance, and boy, we walked in that room. Here he's engaged to this girl about to be married, and he looks at her and he says, "Who are you? Am I supposed to know you?" You know, fortunately, I've been down this road before, so all the way from that airport to that hospital, boy, I'm prepping him. See, it's very important to prepare a person for what they may encounter in this kind of a situation. Those who are confused as to their identity, that is, familiar people events go out. They're pronounced alcoholics, they have a practice of uncontrolled homosexuality. They're bedwetters, we call it enuresis. I'm talking about the guy who comes to a NAV conference and wets the bed. Those who have extremes of emotional responses, man, real highs and real lows, we all have these. But you're talking about a guy who, you know, one moment is, and the next moment he's in grade 19, he's ready to quit. Can happen. Those who have extreme glandular disturbances, it may be in the menstrual cycle if it's a woman. As a man, you have extreme deviation manifesting in obesity, etc. Those who have convulsions, epilepsy, or go into deep form of sleep. I had one of these at Word of Life. I'll never forget as long as I live. We were having a rodeo, and this dear girl was knocking herself out in this. Never told anybody that she was a narcoleptic. And the girl gets into the car sitting next to me and goes, just out. Sleep. So I figured, you know, she's exhausted. I don't mind her using my shoulder. So we get up to go across to the island, and we try to get her out of a car. And I'm telling you, it's like dragging a sack of potatoes out.
And so we picked her up and put her in a boat, all the way over in a boat. I'm taking this cold ice water from Shroom Lake and just throwing it on her face, trying to get her recovered. And boy, when we get her over to the other side, she's out like a light. I said, friend, call that doctor and get him over here. Because, you see, that's a person who can go out just like that and needs extreme medication fast in order to pull her out of it. Those who seem to have no sense of right or wrong, they're compulsive liars, for example. And by the way, that's one of the things our society is producing, which I confronted Glasser with one day. I said, friend, you're in business now, but what are you going to do with the present generation when you say, is it right? And he looks you straight in the eye and says, how in the world do you expect me to know? It is. What's right? You know, you and I take for granted basic things. This is right. You don't take this guy's thing. They say, no, I needed it. Besides, he's got two of them. What do you take it? That's communal living in a lot of these groups. And boy, if you followed the hippie movement, they've had some fantastic conflicts over this. You know, look, whose girl is it? 17, those who are deeply depressed and toy with the idea of suicide. Put this figure down, it will be helpful to you. 94.6% of the suicides not only tell you that they will commit suicide, they tell you how. So there is an idiocy abroad. He talks about it, therefore he'll never do it. Nothing could be further from the truth. This doesn't mean he will do it. It means it is a possibility. And as I said, it's the highest cause of death right now among collegians. And I would say that when you see this type of thing, you know you need some professional help. And it may be that you start with a medical doctor and he may discover the person needs help of a different kind. But this is one place where I begin.
Doctor,
yes.
You started all of these cases with a MD?
Almost always I do. The only one that may not be would be ones like 7 and 8 where you have clear-cut emotional, psychological hang-ups. But in many of these, at least I start there. All right, now, will you look at the list of procedures I've given you as to what a counselor can do in follow-up? Conservation stage. I think most of these become clear to you, but let's look at a few of these procedures. First of all, correspondence. Man, this is a tremendous ministry, and you have the choicest illustration of it right here. Paul's use of letter. And by the way, I would keep copies of your letters because you will discover over a period of time that you can refine them and that you will have similar cases. I have a whole file of letters which I direct to people with very specific problems in given areas. And often people write to me and I have a copy made for him. Prayer. Here again, have you been impressed with Paul's prayer list? It seems to me that he traveled so much, and everywhere he traveled, he ran into another group of people and assured them he would be praying for them. I think it's a bad news principle to say to a person, well, I'll pray for you. You know what my habit is? If a person asks me, would you pray for me? I'll say, right, let's do it right now. And that number one serves to help me remember, plus the fact that at least we will pray now. Because it's very easy to say, well, right, I'll pray for you. But, you know, it's very easy to forget this type of thing. And third, Christian fellowship, the fortress of the family. And I hope you are developing more family consciousness in the net. This has always been a source of great encouragement to me as an outsider. I sense that it's strong, but it's not going to be strong unless you cultivate it and develop that family spirit. Reading. Spate of Christian literature is expanding. People can often do a great deal at home, on their job, in their leisure time, out on a vacation. I always take stuff with me, and have found it very enriching. Personal visits, where they come to see you, where you come to their home, their office. I had a fantastic time visiting with Richard Halverson one day. He said to me, would you like to go visiting with me? Well, you know, the average situation, you'd say, do I really need it? But knowing him as I did, I said, sure, Dick, let's go. So he took me out to a junior high school where one of his men is a principal. And we went into the man's office. We studied the Word together. We had concerted prayer for his needs together. We ate lunch together. We talked about what the Lord was doing in his life together. And at the end of the period of time, he said, you got a couple of minutes? He said, sure. So he said, let's take a walk. So we went out. We walked around that whole city block in a junior high. And when we got to the end of it, he said to this guy, hey, let's claim this place as your base of ministry for Jesus Christ. Right on the sidewalk, we bowed to pray together. I thought to myself, imagine what would happen in the average church if a pastor spent time out on the job with people claiming that as their base of ministry. You see, we always think of the ministry in terms of the church. But the guy's real ministry is usually out in his vocation, his profession, his home, his community. So I think this has a lot of possibilities. Or at the campuses, you spend a lot of time out on the base. Dave Roper out at Stanford never ceases to amaze me. Recent poll on Stanford University campus, the most significant person on campus by the students was Dave Roper, minister to college kids at Peninsula Bible Church. You know why? Because the church pays him to be out there. They don't pay him to stay in here. We expect you to be out on the campus. So he spends all of his time out there ministering to these guys. Telephone. Sometimes just to plug in to encourage a guy. You know, how you doing, Bill? Boy, I found a tremendous thing. Sometimes, you know, between planes or I land and we got 20 minutes before the thing takes off again and I go in, put a dime in, call a guy that was one of my students, say, hi, Prof, how you doing? Oh, great, Prof, where you going? On my way somewhere. Oh, boy, thanks a lot for stopping. Well, I just want you to know I'm still praying for you and thinking about you. Interesting thing is to see the timing of this. Haven't you seen this? You know, you think it's accidental, but friend, you know better than that. It just doesn't happen that way. And oftentimes, I spend a lot of time with a little pad that I have with my name across the top, and I just scribble as I'm on a plane the different guys I think of. Just a word of encouragement. Just wanted you to know I'm praying for you. And I've discovered over the years that you sustain really a very profound ministry of encouragement to people through this thing. Referral, maybe in your area. Maybe the guy's moving to another area and you can refer him to another individual. The gospel broadcast, telecast, back to the Bible, things of this type. Tape. I have done a lot of counseling, frankly, by tape. I don't really enjoy it that much, but I do it because I think it's a very helpful means when I don't have any other access. And a guy writes to me and talks about his problems, and I just pick up my recorder and send him a little cassette. But it has the additional element of the warmth of your voice, of your personal concern. Now, let me mention a few other things, and then I'll open it up for the brief time we have for questioning. In the back of your manual, you will find an article, which to me is highly significant. I would suggest you ought to read it once a month. It's entitled Promoting Mental Health in the Pastor. Please cross out pastor and put navigator. It's interchangeable. Dr. Van Noord delivered this address at a seminary, and I have never seen anything have the impact that this has had on a man who repeatedly reads it. You know, one of the great lessons of life, gentlemen, is learning how to sustain good mental health. Are you married to a woman who's got it? If you do, never wake up any day without thanking God for it. It is the greatest asset you've got going for you. I would have quit the ministry so many times I'd lost count, except for that dear woman upstairs. She's the most constant person. I don't care what the conditions are. I always know when I walk in that door what it's going to be like on the other side. Never vary. And she has taught me practically so many principles of mental health that I never learned in my home, because my home was a spawning ground for all kinds of neurotic characteristics. In fact, my closest friend, our psychiatrist on our seminary board, says, Hendricks, there's only one explanation for you, and that's supernatural. No psychiatrist in America can explain your case. And he couldn't be more right. And the same thing is true of you. Don't look at me that way. There are 10 pitfalls that he calls the pampered pet, eager beaver disease. Boy, that's almost navigator bred. Laziness. Well, you'll never get that one unless you're covering. Squirrel cage liver. Formalityism. I haven't seen too much of that. The I live in a glass house complex. Sad Samitis. The interesting thing is you will so identify with this you'll think he's talking about you. And he is. Kinds of traps into which you fall, particularly when you become a choice instrument in God's hand. And the more God uses you, the more you're susceptible to these traps. Now, I'm going to give you some books. But before I do, let me say just a word about team counseling, because I promised to mention something with it. I would suggest, men, that you think more in terms of a team counseling ministry with your wife, especially in the realm of premarital and marital counseling. It is a winner. Now, one of the things that you discover is that when you and your wife are counseling a couple, you get great advantage because there's always one person who's not emotionally embroiled. They are listening and therefore have much more objectivity. And the interesting thing is, when I start pressing in on a woman too far, my wife picks it up just like that. And she immediately comes in. And the interesting thing is, when I find her challenging, you see, my wife can challenge a man much more than I can. And in a counseling situation, she can say to him, let me tell you how a woman feels about that. And boy, she starts in. And sometimes I find it is becoming so threatening, friend, this guy's being nailed to the wall, practically speaking. And you just go so far. And then give her the sign, and we take him off the hook for a minute until we come around another end and then start him to another level of penetration. The truth of the matter is, I would say I have increased my effectiveness in marriage counseling 70% since I have taken my wife in. And a lot of research has been done in this area, and some of the most significant results are coming out of it. And I would share it with you, because I know some of your wives, and I know their tremendous gifts and abilities. And there are a lot of sane, healthy, biblically oriented women, boy, who really can do it. All right, let me suggest four books for you. A brief evaluation of these. Number one, Jay Adams' book, Competent to Counsel, Presbyterian and Reformed Publishing House. It's a paperback. In my judgment, the most significant book to appear in the last decade. A refreshing change. Committed to the full authority of the Scripture. In my judgment, it is an oversimplification, though a needed corrective. In Adam's diagnosis, problems are only twofold: sin, sickness, moral, organic. And to me, this overlooks the whole area of emotional problems, and it may be a question of semantics on his part, but in terms of my clinical experience, I could absolutely not accept his conclusion. And I couldn't do it on biblical grounds either. Second, a book by Rollo May. M-A-Y, The Art of Counseling. I'm not sure if that's Macmillan. I'm sorry I don't have the publisher on it, but it's very accessible. Be sure to get it in a paperback. It's much less expensive. This is not written from a Christian point of view at all, but it'll give you more of the basic principles than you'll get in any book in a short space, particularly dealing with emotional problems. The third book is the book to which we've alluded by William Glasser, Reality Therapy. It's Harper and Row. Now, actually, William Glasser gives you the secular viewpoint of almost the same concepts that Adams gives you. The Adams was trained with Glasser, not so much with Glasser as he was with Maurer at Illinois, but Maurer and Glasser are of the same fraternity. And he quotes him quite excessively in the book. And what Adams tried to do is to take Glasser's reality therapy, Maurer's crisis in psychiatry, and so forth, and put it in a Christian frame of reference. And I think he did a masterful piece of work. A fourth booklet I would suggest you get is one we have produced at the seminary called Christian Counseling for Contemporary Problems. This is a mimeograph production to this stage. It comes in a binder, I think sells for $5.95 postpaid. What it does is take contemporary problems beginning with abortion, adoption, and coming on down through about 40 or 50 crucial problem areas. Gives you how to diagnose the problem, what are the dynamics of the problem, how, what scriptures would you use in the problem, and then some resources as to where to go to help for it. We're constantly revising the thing. It is available through the seminary book room, 3909 Swiss Avenue. 3909 Swiss Avenue, Dallas, Texas. The zip is 75204. Don't write to me. That'll only delay it if you're interested in getting it. Write to the seminary book room. And the interesting thing is that we have had more feedback from various professional sources that this is probably one of the most helpful resource tools on the market today. One psychiatrist professor at Yale said to me some time ago, Hendrix, that's got to be a masterpiece if for no other reason than its scriptural citations. And what we have done over the years, as a result of clinical experience, working with people with these problems, picking the brains of people who have been doing that, put these scriptures down. And I think you'll find it very helpful. You'll identify with it like crazy because obviously it's written from a Christian point of view. Jack?
Howie, two or three times you referred to demon possession. Could you give us a little insight into that as far as the differences in the hang-ups that people have, what are the symptoms that are noticeable?
The only noticeable symptoms that we're finding, and by the way, I'm a neophyte in this. My students have more experience with this than I do, and we're working together. I'm trying to learn from them. Because, as I mentioned, we had 14 cases of this out at SMU this past year. And I have two students who have been remarkably used by God in this thing. And by the way, if you ever get involved in it, don't become a faith healer. This is what happens with that. I believe in faith healing, not faith healers. And I think the same thing toward demon possession. I think it's a dangerous thing to start running around telling everybody, I cast out demons. Watch it. But what we have discovered is this, Jack, that a person will respond very favorably to spiritual things. In other words, he's perfectly normal and responsive, interested. And then all of a sudden just gets the most dramatic depression, hostility, reactionisms of various forms set in. So that you know that there's something deeply resistant to this type of thing. And often you inquire with the person, and maybe they've even been under psychiatric care but have had no success whatever. We have one of our students. Frankly, I missed it myself. And I sent him to Dr. Montgomery, and he was very helpful in many respects, but he too missed it. And he treated him in a traditional fashion, thinking this was legitimately the problem. But it wasn't to get a demon possession. And I don't know much about it. In fact, I don't know anybody that knows very much about it, because, you know, we used to think it was just back there in the past. And occasionally we'd say, well, yes, yeah, some missionary told us he saw it, you know, out there in dark Africa where it's pagan. Well, friend, it's as pagan in America as it is in Africa. In fact, in East Africa, it's more Christian than it is here. Revival is absolutely fantastic in East Africa right now. It's a phenomenon of the 20th century. But most Christians know nothing about it. And I think that the more pagan our culture becomes, the more you will find the characteristics of paganism. And I think that this is one of them. Dr. Willard Aldrich had a severe case of this up at Multnomah this year. They had a girl they prayed with for 3 solid days. As far as they could figure, had about 7 or 8 key demons, each one of which has a name, by the way. And
necessarily connected with
spirit. No, except in this way, Jack, and thanks for bringing that up, because Warren or somebody and I were talking about this the other day. This is one reason why I would say to you, this is one place to be very dogmatic, very categoric, very pontificate. And that is, when you're working on a campus, you're working on a military base, and you got people who are in the process of being discipled, and they're horsing around with the horoscopes, with the cards, with the fortune tellers and the rest, you better get very directed with them to stay out of it. And don't you get close to it. I said, oh, I'm going over to see what's going on. Baloney. Friend, you're liable to get over there too close. Boy, and the first thing you know, you're in it. We've had cases of this. With this, you know, just interested. Mm-mm. You're playing with the greatest of them. You're playing with a force far greater than you. And therefore, I say, boy, you know what I do? Flee youthful lust, boy, take off in the opposite direction. And one of our problems today with this whole business, even of Christian liberty, that's been warped, is, you know, wherever I go, I find a guy saying, well, I got liberty. Really? You got the liberty not to do it, too. You ever think of that one? And he's always trying to figure out how close he can come to sin and survive. Uh-huh. How far you can get away from it, and how close you can get to the Lord. And boy, I'm telling you, I've been in situations like this, I've run out the front door of the thing. Pulling my students with me. Because this you're not playing games with this kind of stuff. They're playing for high stakes, and they're playing for keeps. And the amazing thing is how deeply entrenched this is in our culture with people. I was telling Gene, I forgot to tell her. I got on a plane over here, forget where in the world I am, somewhere, what difference does it make? And before I got on a plane, this guy got this horoscope that he picked up at the newsstand, he sat down, he's running through that baby to get, you know, Harry, whatever he is, on
And he reads down and says, do not take a trip today. Oh, my God. Closes the thing, gets up, goes over, cancels the flight. Now, I don't know who the guy was, but I'll clue you. He was probably a businessman, very well dressed, very well speaking. I'm telling you, people will never open the day without consulting some of this stuff. In Dallas, we now have it on the air 14 times a day with a little stupid statement at the end of it, this is not intended to foster a belief in this. Who are you kidding? What do you put it on for if it has no validity? Because they just suck people into this type of trap. And I find a lot of Christians playing around with a lot of nonsense, too, on this type of thing.
I attended a management seminar about a year ago at the University of Wisconsin, and this guy was really sharp, and he was listing the various forms of management that there are prevalent in our country today, and the last one that he mentioned very seriously, even though he got a laugh in the audience, was Horace Orr.
Very interesting.
Top executives that use that as their primary source.
Unbelievable. Gentlemen, this has been a great source of joy to me. You know what my prayer is? That God will help you to walk in the path of the one who was a wonder as a counselor. And he knows how to counsel, and he's perfectly able to communicate to you. And he'll teach you. Now, we're going to take a break here till 10:30. And I would appreciate it very much from my point of view if we could get back here on time at 10:30, because I got a half hour chopped off of this thing to begin with. And I want to give you the whole package as much as I can, but it'll take me at least the hour to do it, I think, effectively. So, okay? Yeah.
Can you recommend a book on mental possession that would be helpful?
No, I would recommend a book by my colleague, Dr. Unger, Merle Unger, on demonology, which is a biblical treatment of it. Probably the best thing I've ever read.